of the Iranian people's extraordinary resilience and unwavering determination. Despite enduring severe hardships during the eight-year war, when virtually the entire world stood against Iran, they persevered. Even in the challenging years following the revolution, Iran managed to overcome immense obstacles, ultimately emerging victorious and displaying remarkable strength.
From reconstructed front lines to artifacts of fallen soldiers, the museum offers more than history. It conveys a message that victory comes not just through arms, but through faith and national unity. The journalists listening closely as the guides explain how the Iranian people, civilians and soldiers alike, stood shoulder to shoulder to defend their homeland. The experience led the visiting journalists to draw powerful parallels between Iran's wartime past and its present-day resistance to foreign aggression.
Things like peace through strength and, you know, peace through war, all this just nonsense. It's nonsense. And what I'm taking from this museum is Iran never sought out war or aggression upon anyone. And all of the war, the imposed wars upon Iran, they never sought that out. It was imposed upon them by imperial powers.
As far as these foreign journalists are concerned, the museum underscores how, for Iranians, defending the homeland is deeply rooted in their faith, culture, and collective identity.
Here, the visiting journalists see not only the scars of war, but the unity, resilience, and overwhelming faith that has led to the victory of the Iranian nation. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Italy's former Prime Minister and opposition five-star movement leader Giuseppe Conte has accused Giorgia Meloni's far-right government of violating international norms by maintaining military ties with the Israeli regime.
Si chiama genocidio.
What is happening in Gaza goes under the name of genocide. The genocidal intent is evident. Italy's government has made a mockery of the country by not requesting any sanctions against Israel. We expected you to at least tear up this memorandum, as Italy's military ties affect support violations of human rights and international norms. How do you intend to continue importing weapons from Israel? This is an act that makes you complicit in the violation of international law.
Conte's remarks came after Italy's Chamber of Deputies rejected a motion by opposition parties Five Star Movement, the Democratic Party, Greens and Left Alliance and Italian Socialist Party to suspend a 25-year-old Italy-Israel Memorandum of Understanding by 142 votes to 102. The memorandum revolves around Rome and Tel Aviv cooperation in the military sector. On June 8, while the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza continued to escalate, Italy's government renewed its military cooperation agreement with Tel Aviv. This memorandum of understanding, in place since 2005, is automatically renewed every 5 years, unless one of the two parties explicitly decides to suspend or terminate it. In late May, in response to the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, the regional governments of Puglia and Emilia-Romagna formally severed all institutional ties with the Israeli regime. Italy's national government has not even been able to speak a word of solidarity for the thousands of civilian Gazans slaughtered by war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu.
C'è una sudditanza che giustifica.
Italy is utterly subjugated to Israel. We keep supplying Tel Aviv with military materials, including ammonium nitrate and tritium, and importing weapons from Israel. The amount of arms we imported tripled in 2024 compared to the year before.
Our motion was a strong message given by all opposition forces in the face of Netanyahu's brutal attacks that continue to kill Gazans and hitting even a Catholic church in the strip. Our government must condemn once and for all Israelis' extermination of Palestinians.
Italy is the third Israeli regime's arms supplier following the US and Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens gathered on Khalid bin al-Walid Street in Damascus, rejecting Israeli aggression and expressing firm support for Syria's unity. The strikes, which hit near residential areas, were seen as a provocation aimed at deepening internal strife. Protesters raised Syrian flags and voiced rejection of sectarianism, foreign plots, and war. Many see the airstrikes as part of a wider plan to reignite conflict and shatter the country's fragile recovery. Chants echoed through the streets. No to treason, no to foreign intervention. Protesters called for civil peace and solidarity with Soweda, vowing to defend every inch of Syrian territory against division and outside manipulation. From Damascus to Soweda, Syrians are speaking in one voice. No to war, no to division. As Israeli airstrikes try to fracture the country, citizens respond with defiance and unity stronger than ever. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
His name may not have made headlines, but to those who knew him, Haj Ramazan was a legend. Now, in the wake of his martyrdom, an entire nation commemorates the life and sacrifice of Major General Mohammad Said Izadi, known by friends and peers as Haj Ramazan.
He dedicated over 35 years of his life to the Palestinian resistance. He was a key figure in supporting Palestine as he was head of the division in charge. His unwavering commitment shaped the resistance movement and earned him respect for his dedication to the Palestinian cause.
A key force behind Iran's support for Palestine, he was revered for his humility. His martyrdom in the recent Israeli aggression has drawn widespread condemnation and renewed vows to carry forward his mission. A special tribute video played during the memorial left many in attendance deeply moved, as they admitted they had never realized just how instrumental Haj Ramazan was in support for the Palestinian resistance.
Those who support Israel are stabbing Palestine in the back, and those who martyr the supporters of the resistance are betraying Palestine. What this revered martyr left behind is a legacy of resistance. We must keep his memory alive by continuing his path in the fight against oppression. What better honor than to sacrifice for this valuable cause?
This memorial affirms a collective vow to preserve the memory of martyr Haj Ramazan and continue his unwavering support for the resistance, echoing across generations and all who stand for justice. Honoring this revered martyr, his steadfast commitment to defending and supporting Palestine inspires continued resistance. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
He was the voice of Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone, a documentary that follows 13-year-old Abdullah as he guides viewers through the devastation of his hometown. In February, the BBC pulled the film from its video-on-demand service, the iPlayer, after it turned out Abdullah's father was a civilian official in the Hamas government. The BBC said it didn't know about his family connections. Now Britain's media regulator Ofcom is investigating whether viewers were misled. But critics are asking why Ofcom has chosen this moment to act when the BBC has a decades-long record of bias that has consistently favored Israel.
Hearing that Ofcom will investigate the BBC didn't come as a shock at all. Reason being is we've seen regulators across the board, from the charity regulator to Ofcom to the regulators of print media, coming in essentially to rescue the pro-Zionist narrative whenever it's in trouble. And here it's continuing that same trajectory of enabling, defending, obfuscating from Israel's live stream genocide that's happening now in Gaza.
Over months, the public broadcaster has been vilified by the public over its pro-Israel bias with no action from Ofcom. But a Palestinian child documenting genocide crossed the line.
What's actually happening here? And what's happening here is that a powerful, hard-hitting documentary exposing the realities on the ground in Gaza, demonstrating clearly through eyewitness testimony and experiences on the ground what's taking place day to day in the lived experience of Gazans, living through the Israeli brutality, the blockade, the starvation, the genocide. And we're being told, hold on, Palestinians are disingenuous. We cannot trust their testimony. and even their children could be spoon-fed lines about how devastating the circumstances is.
Last month, the BBC pulled another documentary, Gaza, Doctors Under Attack, over what it called concerns about impartiality. The film was instead aired by two separate broadcasters, one in Britain, the other in the U.S. Before that, calls for the director general of the BBC, Tim Davie, to resign for airing Palestine solidarity, including this chant by musician Bob Villain at the Glastonbury Music Festival.
Critics say this is not about media standards, it's about policing Palestinian voices while letting decades of pro-Israel distortion pass unchecked. For many years, Ofcom in that building remained silent. It's speaking now, only, they say, to silence Palestinians. Saipur is of London.
Tehran's war wounds telling the haunting story of the Israeli aggression. On day one of a four-day press tour, foreign journalists are guided through residential neighborhoods targeted. The delegation walking through the rubble, where shattered windows, collapsed walls, and twisted metal frames remain a visible testament. A Red Crescent aid worker sharing a first-hand account of the recent strikes, describing the heartbreaking challenges of providing aid in war-torn areas.
When we arrived, I saw a man trapped in the rubble up to his neck on my right. We tried to get him out immediately, but unfortunately, his arms had been torn off and he had suffered severe injuries.
Survivors and neighbors, still shaken, recounting the terrifying moments of the attacks and the devastating aftermath.
We live just across from this building. As you can see, all the windows were shattered. Suddenly, everything turned to dust in my face. I still don't know how I got out or who pulled me out.
I was about to take my car out of the parking garage. I had just stepped out and walked into our apartment when two explosions went off. I don't remember anything after that. They say I was in shock.
Just outside the city, the group visits Tehran's Behesht Zahra Cemetery, where a new section is reserved for martyrs of the Israeli aggression.
I saw what bombs or rockets can do, and if it falls on a civilian building, it's horrible to see that. But let me say also that I think every civilian who dies in a war, even every soldier, is one soldier and one civilian too much. These kind of things, as intelligent humans, shouldn't exist.
We saw firsthand the destruction of civilian areas Israel falsely claimed were military targets. It's clear Israel often hits civilian sites and denies it. We also witnessed Iran's military strength, a power Arab nations should respect and learn from.
Here, the visiting journalists pause, not only to document, but to reflect. For them, the tragic consequences of the Israeli aggression are no longer distant headlines, but lived realities.
With foreign journalists witnessing firsthand the level of devastation, global accountability is growing regarding the unlawful Israeli aggression. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
It started with one woman standing up for justice. A protester in Canterbury, Kent, silently held a Palestine flag and a Free Gaza placard until the police arrived and threatened to arrest her under terrorism legislation.
My colleagues explained that the support of this, mentioning freedom of Gaza, Israel genocide, all of that, all come under prescribed groups, which are terror groups that have been dictated by the government, all right, which we have suspicion to suggest that you're supporting.
A day later, dozens are marching in Laura's support from that same spot to the city's police station. The message, defending Palestinian rights isn't terrorism. The protest comes less than 2 weeks after the UK government officially prescribed the group Palestine Action, making any support, real or perceived, a potential terrorism offense. But critics say police are now using that ban to target all forms of Palestine solidarity. Canterbury hosts Instro Precision, a subsidiary of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. weapons made here used by Israel against Palestinians. Despite everything, the mood here is defiant, with the protesters galvanized by support from passing motorists.
This isn't about just a person with a flag. The protesters here say it's about the right to speak out against genocide without being branded criminals. And as they raise their fists into the air, a pledge here to keep fighting back and exposing the UK government's enabling of the Gaza genocide. Saipur is up Canterbury, United Kingdom.
Suffering within, this is the love has dyed me in blood. Not I'm wise, neither mad. Your love caused me all the joy, took my heart and made fond of it. Desired to kill. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Now and then, like the winds I blow. Now and then, like the roads I go. Now and then, like the floods I flow. I'm Yunus, mystic of sorrow, suffering wounds from top to toe. In the hands of beloved, I write in woe. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain.
Have a very good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. In 10th century Cordoba, an Umayyad Islamic dynasty city in Spain with over 70 libraries, the palace library alone had over 60,000 volumes, all written by hand. At the time, the best Latin library in Europe had only 600 parchment books. While the Chinese invested paper sometime before the 2nd century BC, Muslims were the first to mass-produce paper on an intercontinental scale, developing a culture dependent on its abundance. As the price of paper dropped, literacy rose and booksellers and libraries became integral parts of every Muslim city. Like Judaism and Christianity, Islam originated in the Middle East. I'm delighted to unveil what's ahead in this upcoming hour. We begin with Islamic Upbringing Guides Parents with Faith-Based Wisdom. This program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. After that, will feature more of our radio productions. Next, we journey into a brief commentary on supplications with Bridge.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and a very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing and I'm your host Zainab, grateful to be here with you hosting another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we try to reconnect with our purpose as parents, as guides, as mentors, while with the teachings and valuable insights of our guest speakers who give us advices based on the Holy Quran and the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the guidance from our noble imams. Well, joining us is Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a scholar whose insights promise to illuminate this subject beautifully because he's known for his deep understanding of both Islamic teachings and modern psychology. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, Brother Liaqat, we would like to ask you about how do you prepare your youth for a married life and a family life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In order for me to prepare my youth for marriage, example, I have to see if he or she, example, if they are having grounds to get married, okay? Because when this is a very sensitive topic, especially when the youth is going through a lot, when he or she are in their 14s, 15s, 16s, this is like the most crucial age, okay? These 3 years, and of course a bit more than that, until 17 as well.
Yeah.
Until 18, they get stable normally. So over in this age, because there are a lot of hormonal changes, and there's a kind of tsunami going inside the mind of the youth. So it's very crucial to understand the youth, okay? What are they having? Like, what feelings do they have right now? And what are their viewpoints about marriage? Because even the youth also has something in the mind,
right?
Yeah? So when do they have to get married and everything else,
right?
Of course, yeah. So understanding my youth, if they are ready for marriage or not in the first place, because, you know, marriage doesn't happen just like that in one day.
Right.
Everything should be there beforehand itself. Like, you know, there should be bulugh, or there should be the maturity,
puberty.
The physical maturity. Other than that, the bulugh, psychological maturity. There should be the financial maturity. Example,
yeah.
If he gets married, how is he going to spend? Like,
yeah.
Is he going to spend wisely or not? Example, yeah. Likewise with the female. If she gets married, she shouldn't be like, what do you say? She shouldn't be like not having any skills,
right,
to do upbringing of her child. Yeah, example. And it also lies upon the shoulder of the parents to see if she's like strong enough for what,
right,
and everything. Everything matters. Yeah. So coming to this, so one side is the parents' side, how and what are they thinking about the youth? The second thing is about the youth himself or herself, if they want to get married. If they
basic
really
ethics,
want to get married,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly, then the parents should guide them. Yeah?
Right.
So with this pre-marital education,
right?
Which is very important, like sending them to the short courses,
right?
Or example, there are courses, there are a lot of courses, I would say,
mm-hmm.
Which are gonna prepare them for the married life, mm-hmm. or the family life, which
all
is
right.
Which is gonna be after they get married, yeah. So, and taking examples from the life of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam,
right.
How they used to live, like how Amirul Mu'mineen used to live with Sayyidah Fatima al-Zahra salamu alayha. How was Rasulullah with his wife Sayyidah Khadijah al-Kubra salamu alayha? You see,
mm-hmm.
So if we take examples from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam, even the lives of scholars,
mm-hmm.
they are very beautiful stories, like how were their married lives and how did they lead their married lives and everything.
So we got to take examples from them.
Sure.
We'll take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor. Allahu Rahim. Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsin. وخالقنا وراسقنا وهو على كل شيء قدير.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how to prepare your youth for marriage and the family life. Well, you talked about the pre-marriage classes, but they are not unfortunately common in all the countries. Like I remember, like when I was getting married, my husband went for those classes and then he would share the notes with me. And I thought, like when he told me he's going for some pre-marriage classes, I laughed at the beginning, and because I had never heard something like that. And still, like when he said pre-marriage class, I was expecting something, maybe some Bollywood romantic drama he'd be learning there, but it was not like that. He would share the notes with me in which there were so many beautiful riwayat, so many beautiful narrations from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and how to be respectful, how to treat your spouses and all, and it was really amazing, really amazing. So I would recommend that parents should go through those, those riwayat, those narrations, and also teach their children about that before they have Inshallah. That, you know, preparing them that for pre-marriage session.
Yeah, yeah, example, spouse selection, pre-marriage, everything. There's another course, spouse selection, how to select your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you select your spouse, like pre-marriage, like because you are going
to certain classes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And post-marriage as well. There are classes even on them. And of course, like, you know, when a person chooses a spouse, it should be because of the faith and not because of beauty or wealth, okay? If a person chooses the spouse because of beauty or wealth, then it might perish one day or the other.
Yeah.
But if it is because of the faith, it will last long, okay? And in Islam, alhamdulillah, the focus is faith. The focus, like, the focus.
Main criteria.
Yeah, the
faith.
Main criteria. And this should be taught to the children.
I think we should highlight this point, like someone marrying on the based on the beauty. When someone does that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala leaves him on that particular thing.
Exactly.
He leaves that person. For example, we remember a case that a person marrying some woman for her green eyes. And then after some time, after certain years of marriage, like everything was going smooth. But after certain years of marriage, he came to consultants saying that I get scared of the same woman. I feel like there's a cat in my house.
Oh,
so,
my
gosh. Yeah, like the same thing, you got married with this person based on some beauty factor. Same thing started being a source of fear for you. So it's not recommended in Islam to be faith. Faith is basically the basic thing.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And there are other things as well, like dua also is recommended for a person to be asking for a spouse. Example, Rabbi habli min ladunka zurriyatan tayyibah. Yeah. So give me a proper, a good offspring. Zurriyatan tayyibah.
More pure.
Halal, pure. Like someone with modesty, everything,
dhurriyatan
tayyibah, a good offspring. And for that good offspring, you have to have a good spouse as well.
Right.
And of course, there are many riwayat. Select a good spouse, select a spouse who has love of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, yeah?
So tomorrow, like many youth sometimes end up in a very weird kind of marriage, and they don't want their parents to... Sometimes they blame their parents, like, you were not there to help or you were not there to guide. So for parents and mentors, what are your suggestions? How do they help the youth in getting a better spouse? But before we get into that, let's take a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here. And we are giving some advices for the parents. How do you prepare your youth for marriage?
So about the person, now it's no longer a child, okay? And now it's a grown-up person,
right.
Adult, like we would say adult. It's no longer a youth or young man or young woman. So about the responsibility of the parents, they should check the family background of the selected one, okay,
mm-hmm.
who's going to be the spouse, okay? Like, how the family members of the opposite person, opposite gender, okay, opposite, like, the spouse.
To make sure that have they taught modesty to their child or not, which is one of the major things.
Yes, and like, the family check is there. And upon the spouse as well, like who's going to be the wife.
To be wed.
To be wed, example, to the son of this person, example. Or vice versa, it doesn't matter. Their character should be known through the friends, example. Friend circle, through the cousins, yeah. A fair checkup should be done. A fair feedback should be taken from these kind of people. Why? Because tomorrow... there shouldn't be any kind of regret. Oh, I wish I would have done a proper research example,
yeah.
Because, you know, there are many cases in this arena, in this place, where people don't do proper research and they unfortunately end up with a lot of regret. Okay, I myself have gone through a lot of cases. Like, people came near me and they were like, Sheikh, you know what? Someone suggested me this girl. And I was like, okay, the girl is good. How are the family members? They are good. And that's it. That was enough for me. You see? Like, the girl is good. The family members are good.
That's enough.
That's enough. Really? I was like, really? Actually, the problem was he saw the girl's money as well. She's from a well-to-do family. Exactly. So, yeah, the girl is also good. Like, he spoke to her once. And she spoke to him nicely. And they got married. And after that,
there was a disaster.
There was a
real
big disaster, yeah. I would say. And
so
there were issues, yeah.
Right, so it's the duty of the parents to help their child selecting a correct spouse based on the Islamic criteria. Like we said, like, go for a family background checkup and look for the friends he hangs around with or she hangs around with, because a man is known through the company they keep. And also, you said faith should be looked upon. Faith is a major thing. The basic Islamic criteria is faith, and have a check on that and help your adolescents and your to be wed children to get these criteria checked properly. So, because you know, as adolescents, all these different states of development come with their own challenges, but at the same time with opportunities. It's crucial that we, as the caregivers and community members, recognize these distinctions, and in order to nurture our youth effectively, we learn the Islamic criteria and also pass it down to the generations. Thank you, Brother Liaquat Abbas. Thank you, dear listeners. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life.
of borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Why should a mother cry?
our diplomats have played pivotal roles in shaping international relations, navigating complex geopolitical landscapes, and fostering dialogue between conflicting parties. These individuals often bring unique insights and strategies to the table, influencing the course of history through their work. People like my guest today, who has dedicated his career to bridging divides and promoting understanding, leaving a lasting impact on global diplomacy. Welcome to SOAP. I am Bahman Roy, your host. Alistair Crook is a former British diplomat and intelligence officer born in 1949. He's had an extensive career in international relations, serving as the security advisor to the EU Special Envoy to the Middle East and working with Islamist movements such as Hamas and Hezbollah. Crook founded the Beirut-based Conflicts Forum, an organization aimed at fostering dialogue between political Islam and the West. He's also authored the book Resistance, The Ascent of the Islamist Revolution. Mr. Alistair Crook, it's indeed an amazing honor to have you here on the SOAP show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And you played a role in kind of facilitating ceasefires in conflict zones. Mm. Can you tell us about those experiences?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes there'd be something, there'd be a car bomb go off in a nightclub and there would be huge casualties. And the Israelis were then promising, Israelis were then threatening to destroy all of the Palestinian Authority. And Solana would come to me and say, all right, we've got to have a ceasefire now. And I would say to him, you know, I'm not King Canute. I can't sit at the edge of the sea and tell it to, you know, the tide to change. It doesn't. Yes. But I mean, he still, you know, I said, you really have to have the right ability. And he said, well, you know, we've got to do it because otherwise, I mean, the Israelis are going to go on the rampage and they're going to destroy everything in the Palestinian Authority hospitals, the civil. So I started off against, you know, with a great skepticism, going to the Gaza, West Bank. I did town hall meetings with in these towns where I invited everyone to come and ask me why I was calling for the ceasefire Hudna, why I was asking for it, what was its purpose. And of course, you know, a lot of people were really angry at this and hostile. I mean, a great deal of hostility. You know, they would come into these meetings and put a Kalashnikov pointing at you to underline the point that they had a disagreement with your position. But we went round and round. And eventually there would be a sense that it's worth to have a ceasefire. But still then, it seemed to me that it was not going to work. And I had to go back to Arafat every day and say, Arafat, tell this man in Khan Yunis, these are the orders, this he has got to work with me. Right. Every night, backwards and forwards, to get the power aspect of it, the authoritative aspect of the ceasefire. Ceasefires require a lot of work to get them to function properly. So I go back, and then the last thing I did was, and they thought I was crazy, and I went around all the leaders of that, and I said, I want you to phone each other, all of you together, saying, you know, this is really interesting. I think, you know, we could have a ceasefire developing. I think a ceasefire is coming. I don't care if you don't believe it. Of course you don't believe it. Just get on the telephones. And that was when the Israelis started to believe something was changing and something was happening because they were intercepting all the telephone calls. And so, you know, I mean, that's just one example, but another example is you know, and then sometimes the ceasefires could nearly collapse for accidental reason. One I was doing in Bethlehem, very hostile condition. I had to walk through the Israeli lines, the paratroops who held fire while I walked through them at 2 in the morning. And then eventually I walked into the Tanzim lines. I got a shout from behind a wall, told me to move. So I moved, and I was in a very hostile situation. And I explained what was afoot, what was being proposed. And then suddenly someone burst in, and he said, he's lying. He's completely lying. It's a trap. And I thought this was literally the end. And what had happened was a whole division of tanks had arrived at the foothill of Bethlehem. And I quickly tried to telephone to make some contacts and say, you know, what the hell are tanks doing there? Have you betrayed me? I mean, because if so, I'll be dead.
Yes.
And they said, no, no. And then the message came back. This was a routine change of forces, and these had come down. I can't remember where it was. They'd come down from Hebron, and they were on their way somewhere else, and they'd just parked for rest and recreation and for the troops to be able to pee, but not to attack the in Bethlehem. But it was hard to get it back on the line. It still nearly collapsed. And we went around looking for where the firing was coming from, and I would have someone, a spotter, on the other side, and we'd go and try and crush that or go back to Arafat to get it stopped until there was a ceasefire.
Well, I would like to ask my third question about the issue and kind of talk about the issue of ceasefire in Palestine right now. But before that, short clip.
Spring 2008. While Israel celebrated its 60th anniversary, its neighbor Lebanon was again plunged into crisis. Hezbollah, branded by the West as a terrorist organization, was showing its power. The West responded with their favorite statement, "We don't talk to terrorists." Backlight went to Lebanon for a closer look, as many feel this is where the key to the region's future lies.
Hello, Hussein. It's Alistair.
Tell us about this experience.
You know, this was at the height of the war on terror. And we were trying just to, if you like, open a few lines of communications. And you had to try and be, as I've indicated before, constructive to try and do it. So one of the things we did to sort of break the issue, which was, I don't know what date that was, but about this time, was on Al Jazeera. Who was the head of it? Bin Gidr, I can't remember who was the head of it. But we organized that I and a former very senior CIO officer would sit with the deputy head of Hamas and the deputy head of Hezbollah, and we would have an open discussion.
Right.
And this was the first time anywhere. I mean, this was at the height of the war on terror, and this was the first time, you know, and it had a huge audience. 60 million at the time was a lot. I mean, you know, they asked us very direct questions and answers, and there was Hezbollah and Hamas and a European official and the CIA officer answering these. And I think only by this sort of shocking, you know, trying to shock a little the system into change, can you try and bring that sort of shift. I did it once more in Canada, and I went and gave a talk to a lot of businessmen in that was asked to talk about the resistance, the Islamist groups. And so we had a little sort of backdrop while we were preparing for the talk, and there was an orchestra playing, etc. And so on. And I gave my talk, and I said, you know, I just want to say to you, when you say you have nothing to talk about these groups, that you won't talk to them, I don't know if you realize, but what you were watching was a Hezbollah orchestra playing a Western music. And you say you can't talk to people like that? How come you can't talk to them? And I think that also had a little bit of a shock to the system. But it's hard now, and I know you do these things in Press TV, and this is what you're trying to do with this festival, in encourage people, and many of them, I thought of the things we saw, had a huge vitality and energy, and young people being creative. And so it's very good to encourage them.
Right.
It was very important to encourage them.
Right. My question is, what motivated you to establish the Conflicts Forum?
The work I was doing irritated someone at the highest level, the U.S. president, who effectively told the Europeans that I was out. Monday, finish.
Yeah.
So I started that in the wake of that.
And the other thing that I wanted to know, can you discuss the impact of your book, Resistance, the Ascent of the Islamist Revolution, and the effect it had on public discourse?
I can't tell you, I'm always, it's always the same problem. When my wife asked me, what did you say or what effect does it have if you give a talk? And I say, I never know. You'd know better than me if it has any effect or not. I don't try and measure that. So I don't know. But it was the prelude to this other book, which is not published, which was, as I say, a much longer look at all of this issue and about the resistance as a whole. If I might say so, is sort of pertinent to what I think you're trying to do and what I would say is missing from what I was seeing. Where was in Afghanistan when I first went there, which was before bin Laden and the Wahhabis arrived there, it was a very diverse place. The Kandahar, which we now think of as sort of hardline Salafist, was actually Sufi more than anything else, and there were Shi'i also groups that were there. There was Gilani, Mujahideen, others, all Sufist and different forms. And then in the north you had Ahmad Shah Massoud, who had a sort of, if I can put it like this, a Maoist concept of Islam. When I say that to Westerners, they go nuts and they say, what, Mao? Yeah. And Islamism? God, want nothing to do with that. And then Gilgit in the north was all Sufi, really, too. And then we went through the period. I won't go into it. But when I left it, after what had happened, and I had warned Washington, I went there and I gave a talk to people, and I said, you actually have to differentiate political Islam and not lump it into one thing. Right. You have to have a differentiated understanding. Some of these groups are going to be really dangerous in the future. And you ought to be aware of that, and you ought to take that into account. Others will be, servants of their own communities and or positive things. And I went and said the same to Prince Turki, who was the head of Saudi intelligence at the same time. And he just smiled and said nothing. America said to me, oh, listen, Alistair, we listened real hard to your warnings about these groups, people like Gulbuddin Hikmatyar and so on. But those people you're warning about, those very people, they sure kick communist ass. And this was, the introduction of the extreme Salafists was about kicking ass, as it was in Syria. And now, and I gave a talk in Russia the other week, and I said, I see the same thing happening now in Syria. Syria has had Salafism. It has Levantine Sunnism. It has a huge diversity. And now the West has introduced, West and Turkey, have introduced Shara, who is an ISIS figure, extreme, the most reductive, narrow, scientific, so-called Salafism. the opposite of what, you know, the Sufi existence in that, and also the diversity. So you're going to end up like Afghanistan, which is now wall-to-wall Salafism. That's going to be, except that in Syria it's going to be worse, because you're creating the fusion between the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS. And that is going to affect everything. Is going to be hugely destructive of groups like that believed, as Ahmad Shah, as Sheikh Yassin did, and Sinwar, that actually it was about national liberation and an anti-colonial. They went far back in terms of, you know, the post-war Bandung ideas and conference about these things. And this sort of fragmentation of Islam has been very evident to me, and Syria is a perfect example of this process. And I think I would say to you, what is so important is, in a way, you know, the activism needs to be encouraged, and is obviously, there's some very, you know, committed, passionate activists.
Right.
But there needs to be the sort of sense of a liberation project. And this is why they took Al-Quds, I mean, they took Al-Aqsa as the front of centerpiece, you know, the Al-Aqsa flood. I mean, because it isn't Sunni, it isn't Shi'i, it isn't Salafist, it isn't Muslim Brotherhood. It represents a thread of civilization, of Islam, including all its tensions and ups and downs, but it is a thread of Islam that was important. And I think that was the only thing I would say that I felt from this conference, is the need to sort of go beyond the activism to sort of having a vision.
Yes.
A vision that is not literal, but is a vision that can energize and bring people together and not see the fragmentation, where now we have this sort of Egyptians in Syria promoting a Muslim Brotherhood revolution in Egypt, and, you know, the same thing happening in Jordan. I mean, everything is fragmenting and breaking up.
Of course.
And the question is how to pull everything, if you like, together.
Mr. Alistair Crook, it was a pleasure to have you on this show.
Thank you very
much. As we approach the end of the program, of course, this is a tradition here, that these final minutes, our audience becomes yours. So feel free to say whatever you want to our audience.
I think that we are in a period of huge turmoil, and I think it is going to get worse. The European Western Center is going to radiate tension and polarization as it goes through this catharsis that it is facing. And that what I would say is that we are not going to come through this until we have moved beyond, if you like, postmodern nihilism, and understand the need for a vision that transcends the nihilistic vision which has so damaged our societies. Whoever can take the lead or play a part in that will be doing a service to all in this time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Alistair Crook. It was a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you, our lovely audience, once again. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Nuraei.